Hello and welcome to all our listeners. This is the first of a series of podcasts that we're going to be producing around the world of surrogacy. We're going to touch on many different aspects of surrogacy journeys and the legalities and how it works over the course of this series, but you join us for the first. So what I will do is I will hand over. We've got some brilliant guests with us here today that will cover various aspects of their journeys and what brought them into surrogacy. And the intention of this podcast is to kind of quash some of the misconceptions around what motivates surrogates, the legalities around a surrogacy journey, and some of the misconceptions that have been out on social media over the past few years. I think what I'll do first is I'll hand over to Sarah, who is our head of surrogacy and one of the directors of Surrogacy UK, to tell us a bit more about the organisation. Sarah?
So I'm over at Surrogacy UK, and Surrogacy UK is an organisation, a not-for-profit organisation that operates in the UK that helps to support surrogates, intended parents and families through surrogacy, through their surrogacy journey. We've been going for about 21 years now, and we've grown considerably in that time. There's a couple of thousand members in Surrogacy UK. We've had over 400 births through Surrogacy UK, and currently we have around 250 active surrogates. And an active surrogate is somebody that is either looking for intended parents, getting to know intended parents, trying to conceive, pregnant, or are awaiting their next journey. So we've grown considerably over the last 21 years, but we maintain our ethos that we started with, which is that surrogacy should be altruistic. It shouldn't be for commercial purposes for the surrogate or for the organisation, and that we operate very much a friendship first model, which basically means that surrogates and intended parents can meet through the organisation, build up foundations of a really solid friendship before deciding to go on a surrogacy journey together. And there's the expectation that all parties will have long-standing friendships that go on past the birth of the baby, and that the surrogates and the completed family will remain in each other's lives for a lifelong sort of commitment to each other. So that's it in a nutshell.
Thanks, Sarah. We're also joined by Hazel, Jen and Esme, who are surrogates themselves, and we'll come on to you guys in a few moments. So, Sarah, you mentioned the friendship first ethos. Is that ethos exclusive to Surrogacy UK, or is that generally how surrogacy works in the UK as a whole?
I think it's a very common theme in UK surrogacy. I wouldn't say that every surrogacy journey in the UK is like that. Obviously, people have preferences. Some intended parents, some surrogates do not wish to have a relationship afterwards, and that's absolutely fine. But on the whole, what I've experienced over the last 21 years is people remaining in each other's lives after baby's been born. I think a lot's been learnt from the adoption community about how important it is for children to know of their roots, to know of their life story and how they were born and how they were created. That's sort of a common theme amongst a lot of surrogacy in the UK, I think.
Obviously, for the benefit of our listeners, there are numerous surrogacy organisations within the UK, Surrogacy UK being the UK's leading surrogacy organisation. And I understand that you don't need to be organisation-led when it comes to starting your surrogacy journey. You can choose to do that independently as well, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. At the moment, the laws in the UK mean that surrogacy isn't regulated in any way, which does sort of lend itself to different ways of doing surrogacy. I think on the whole, though, in general, even in some of the more established independent groups on Facebook, they do want to behave sort of ethically, and they've heavily promote safer surrogacy. So although we're not regulated and we don't have to do a lot of things like background checks and health and wellness checks and you know, spending time getting to know each other. That's kind of been adopted throughout the UK surrogacy community. There are obviously plans to change that law and that surrogacy is going to be regulated in the future, which is a really positive thing and something that the UK surrogacy community, especially at Surrogacy UK, have fought for surrogacy to be regulated to ensure that it's safer for everybody undertaking surrogacy.
Thanks, Sarah. You've touched upon some of the legal aspects, and I'd like to come back to that in a bit more depth a little bit later on. But first, I'd like to just open the floor up to our other surrogates that we have here today and just discuss what motivated them to become a surrogate in the first place, and also what kind of drove them to seek out organizations such as Surrogacy UK, as opposed to embarking on their surrogacy journey independently. Hazel, can we start with you, please, and what your motivations, why you decided to become a surrogate and what made you choose SUK, please?
Yeah, of course. I think it's with hindsight, I can see that it was something always on my mind. I've come from a huge family. I've got three gay uncles, and I always thought that they'd make amazing parents, and it seemed very unfair to me that that wasn't an option for them. And then I fell pregnant by chance with my first child. In hindsight, again, very lucky. And we had our second quite soon after that. And I just felt so blessed, is a bit of a cliche word, but that's how I felt, because so many friends were struggling at the time with fertility issues. And I just kept coming back to how did we get so lucky, and how could I help someone else? And nobody in my life really needed help. So we watched a documentary on BBC, The Surrogates, and my partner and I. And I think at the end of the first episode, he turned to me and was like, we need to do this. Oh my goodness. And that's why I applied to SUK, because they seemed so wonderful. And I did do a bit of research and look at the other organizations, but yeah, we just went with SUK and applied to become members with them. And I've never looked back, really.
Thanks, Hazel. Jen, can we come to you next? Same question about what motivated you to become a surrogate in the first instance.
Similar to Hazel, really. It's always been something in the back of my mind that me and my husband had talked about, not too committed to the idea, but we'd come back to it a few times over the years. And we didn't know anyone who needed help, like Hazel mentioned. But generally, just the idea of being kind and helping someone who to have a family is just... I think personally as well, I had a couple of personal reasons that the challenge of it. I have my own daughter who's 16, and she was breached and was born by C-section at the time. So I'd never experienced a natural labour and birth. And personally, that's something that I hoped I could do, and we didn't want any more children. So that was a motivation. Along with being a role model to my daughter, I think... I hope that I've been a positive impact on her seeing our journey and helping someone just because I think it's really good for her to see.
I think that role model aspect is lovely, because obviously Sarah mentioned in her introduction about how the intended parents are almost encouraged to tell the children born through surrogacy about their journey and about how they were created and who helped with that process, etc. And
yeah.
I guess, you know, coming into the next generation, your daughter being part of that, it's almost making her aware of as well that should she run into any difficulties creating her family in the traditional sense when she's older, that there are options out there.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks, Jen. So Esme, moving on to you, same question about what motivated you to become a surrogate, please.
Well, I guess mine didn't really stem till I'd had my own children. So we decided we only wanted two. My husband would tell you he only wanted one, but he's happy now they're both here. So after that, I kind of thought, oh, I'm never going to be pregnant again. That's quite sad, but we definitely don't want any more. And none of my friends or family needed any help, much like the other ladies have said. So then I started to look into it. And I think as soon as you start to look into it, it's kind of game over, really. You've decided that you're going to do it because you realize how many lovely people there are out there that need help for one reason or another. And then you just get deeper and deeper and realize how much of an amazing thing it is and how much you actually want to do it. And in terms of the organisation, I guess I'm slightly different to the others, that I actually met my intended parents on an independent group, and we joined Surrogacy UK as a team, as we decided we wanted the support, as it was both, we were both very new to surrogacy as a concept, but we met quite soon on the group. So we thought, actually, we need some more help here and support. So we joined as a team, and Surrogacy UK were able to offer that.
I've heard a bit of a recurring theme from all of you in telling your stories, your origin stories, if you like, towards surrogacy. And it was the involvement of your partners and the fact that this was all discussed with them in the first instance, and you kind of made the decision to embark on the journey together. Is it fair to say, I think I'll start with you on this, Jen, is it fair to say that you were both kind of in the same mindset and the same place, I guess, from the same starting point? You know, you both kind of discovered it together. Is that fair to say that?
Yes, I would say so. It's something we always spoke about. I definitely did most of the research and fed that back to my husband. But yeah, he was always supportive of it's your body, your choice. You know, if it's something that you want to do, I'll support you in that. And he now understands surrogacy as well as I do. But yeah, it was definitely me who was instigating this. But yeah, with great support from my family.
It's a lot of, we get this a lot via social media and via the media on the whole, that the kind of misconception, I guess, is that surrogates are forced into surrogacy or coerced or hired, to use a few terms. Hazel, you mentioned that you and your husband actually sat and watched a documentary on surrogacy together. So I guess the same for you. It sounds like your husband was very much on board from the offset. Did you feel coerced or forced into it in any way along the lines?
No, honestly, it couldn't be further from the truth. He didn't take much convincing, to be honest. Like I said, once we'd watched the documentary, it just seemed like a no-brainer. And also, like Esme said, the minute that you start delving into it, there's no going back, because SUK is such an, well, surrogacy in general in the UK is such an amazing thing to do. And there was definitely no coercion on this end, no.
Sounds, coercion is probably a bit of a strong word for your husband, but it sounds like, if anything, it was the other way around. It was for you, Esme.
Yeah, my husband has taken a lot of convincing. I've done two journeys now and going to embark on a third, but he's obviously extremely proud and it's my choice and everything, but it's just such a huge toll on our family and the extra support that we need from him that it has taken some convincing.
And you say about the toll taken on the family. I mean, were there reservations from your wider family? I don't know, how you haven't covered how old your children are, but if they were aware of what was involved, or you know, I know some surrogates have spoken in the past about their parents or their in-laws that have expressed concern about what they wanted to do. Was there anything of that from your side of things?
At first, I think my dad was a little bit, I guess, being a daddy's girl, it's just the unknown, isn't it? And the wanting to protect and look after. And it's not the surrogacy, it's my health, I guess, is what people are most concerned around, that you're going through this huge thing for somebody else and they just want me to be okay at the end of it and my feelings. But everyone that goes into it is clear on the path that's going to take place and what's going to happen. So you're mentally prepared that the baby isn't yours, whereas I think a lot of people kind of question your mental sanity, I think, at some point, that like there'll always be one person that is like, but you've given the baby away, like that you weren't prepared that was going to happen, like you didn't go into it with the correct mindset. Well, obviously I know that was going to happen. So I think sometimes you do get those questions, and I guess family are just a bit more open about it than people that you meet on the street. But no, everyone's been incredibly supportive. And I think the first time everyone asked lots of questions, but then the second, now the third, everyone's just like, oh yeah, we guessed you would want to do it again. And I think it helps when my intended parents were amazing and lovely. And to my children, they're like their favorite people ever. So that always helps.
And I think that's a good point that you've made there in terms of everybody's, I think it's probably a fear of the unknown, isn't it? Certainly from a family's point of view, in that they are looking out for your well-being, both your mental well-being as well as your physical well-being. The physical strain that comes with 9 months of pregnancy. And from what I've heard from all of you is that, like you say, this was well researched from the moment of decision, and that you look into it. And, you know, I know, Jen, that you mentioned about, you know, finding out more, and your husband wanted to do research, or you did the research, should I say, rather, for your husband. And it is that, isn't it, where as soon as you approach other people and say, this is what I want to do, they kind of assume, or it sounds like they kind of assume, or the sort of go-to response is they assume that you've just done this on a whim. You know, you've just decided to do this, and you've gone at it full steam ahead without looking into all the aspects of what's involved over the course of your journey. Sarah, obviously, over 21 years, I dare say that you've heard these stories a lot, and you've heard these motivations a lot as well. In terms of mindset, I know that there's a common misconception as well. I mean, we've now heard from these guys about their motivations, but financial struggles, I know, is a common misconception that all surrogates must get into it for the financial aspect. And you mentioned earlier about the commercialization of surrogacy. Do you find that that's probably one of the leading misconceptions around surrogates, that they are all struggling financially, and so they see this as a way of gaining some extra income?
Absolutely. There's always been the perception that surrogates, A, don't work, which is hilarious to me, that surrogates don't have a career, they don't have a job, they're sort of struggling women on benefits, that this is their only option to sort of make money for their family. You know, those sort of common themes have been ongoing for the last two decades. And actually, in reality, the truth is so far away from that, that it kind of makes me laugh a little bit when I read that on the internet. And I sort of do sort of engage with people on Twitter, for example, people that are uneducated about surrogacy in general, and are sort of saying these things as fact, because they genuinely can't believe that another person would do something for somebody else without money being a motivator. And that's always amazed me, because I think that says more about their mindset than my mindset. You know, like, you genuinely can't imagine that somebody would do something for somebody else without there being money involved. And, you know, I see it all the time. A really lovely friend of mine, her husband donated, he was a living organ donator for a friend of his. So he put himself at a great personal medical risk to donate an organ to his friend who needed one. Not one person questioned his motivations. Nobody. Nobody said, well, you must be getting paid for that, because why on earth would you put yourself through that for somebody else? And there's this, you know, it's kind of like, well, that's a good decision, you know, and then surrogacy must be for money, because nobody would go through that if not for money. And people just can't marry the two up, that actually people do lots of things for lots of people just because they want to, without money being a motivator. And it's really hard to sort of convince people that money actually isn't a motivator here at all. And I sort of tell people, you know, if they have children already, well, how much would it cost you to go through labour and birth again? Because there's no amount of money that would make me go through labour or C-sections at all. It has to be for the right reasons. And those right reasons for me were definitely seeing a completed family, you know, creating mums and dads and aunties and uncles and grandparents. And, you know, now my surrogate born children are older, they're adults, two of them are adults now, and knowing that they're actually going to have children, you know, that's the motivation for me, that I've changed somebody's life, and that's something that I can be really proud of, and that my children can be really proud of. And you can't put a monetary value on that. Like, there is no amount of money that could replace that feeling for me.
It's a really good point that you've made there as well, Sarah. I was going to go down the route of people that volunteer for charities, Or, you know, run a marathon for a charity. But the living organ donor that you mentioned is probably the better example, because, you know, it is something that is within you that is then being removed, taken out, and then given to somebody else. But even that, you know, it's like I've never donated an organ myself, but if you were to donate a kidney, for example, you'd never see that kidney again, because it's in the recipient. Whereas from what all of you guys have said thus far is that, and certainly from the Friendship First ethos within Surrogacy UK, is that you will have an ongoing relationship with that child, with your sorrow baby as they grow, as you mentioned, Sarah, into adulthood. So it almost beggars belief that, as you say, somebody wouldn't say, well, why would you want to give your kidney away? Why would you want to give that to somebody? You'll never see it again. There must be some fairly hefty money involved, but there's always something different about a baby. And that brings us nicely into one of the other sort of myths or misconceptions that is always out there in the media and within social media as well, which is the maternal bond that a surrogate must form with her sorrow baby, which would then make it nigh on impossible to, and I'm going to use this term in you'll have to imagine the air quotes, give the baby up to to the intended parents. I mean, I know the surrogates that are joining us here today have all mentioned how they've had their children of their own and they've completed their families. Esme, I think I'll come to you first on this. So you'd mentioned that you had two children. You didn't want any more than that. So in terms of, I mean, could you just comment on that misconception about when the baby is born and it's given to the intended parents, about was there any kind of reservations in your mind about doing that, about giving the baby up for to use that term again, that misconception term again?
No, absolutely not. I 100% didn't want another baby. And I think the thing that people kind of forget is that we could have another baby if we wanted one. So why would we go through all the trouble of growing a baby that's not actually ours to then keep it? It wouldn't make logical sense. If I wanted another baby, I would just have one myself. I wouldn't go and drag another load of people into the mix and have drugs and go through IVF just for that. But no, there was never any want to keep the baby at all. I think it's the same phrase of, I'm just the oven, I was just cooking the bun. It didn't mean I wanted to keep it. So yes, definitely no maternal instinct for the baby at all.
For you, Hazel, because I know you said that your feeling of being blessed when your two children were born, and obviously yourselves and your husband watched the documentary, and I guess that kickstarted your research process. Any sort of feelings or emotions that caught you by surprise upon the birth of your sorrow baby?
Not really. I think I knew the whole way through pregnancy. My surrogate baby is 4 months old today, actually, so it's pretty fresh. But when she was born, it was their faces. It was seeing the look on their faces that just honestly is going to stay with me forever. And for my surrogate baby, obviously you care about them. There's no way you can't care about someone. But also it's more because she's their baby and they're my friends. And I was talking to someone about it the other day, actually, because I was saying, you know, she was born and I expressed milk for her. And my friend thought that was a really intimate thing to do. But for me, it felt like that was her milk, whereas I would have felt really uncomfortable giving her a kiss. This is really, really random thing, but I think that's the distinction. It's not your baby. When my babies were born, you just want to like smush your face into them and you don't want to let them go. But with my surrogate baby, it was just to see her with her parents. There's no words that can really articulate that feeling. And it's different, obviously, to having your own children, but it's almost just as good because you've done that. It's just incredible.
So the surprise for you came in what you were prepared to do for the sorrow baby, and you mentioned not wanting to kiss them versus what you weren't comfortable with doing, I guess.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? But I would never kiss like my friend's children. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm cold or something. But you know, I love my friend's kids and I love spending time with them. But to me, I would never kiss them. Whereas my own children, well, they're 5 and 3 now, and still all I do is kiss them. So that was kind of how it was explained to her. To me, yeah, the expressing milk thing wasn't an intimate thing to me anyway, because it felt like that, well, that was her milk, and I felt quite strongly about her having that, but to kiss her would feel a bit crossing a line. So,
and from what you've said there as well, and Esme said the same or intimated towards the same thing. Jen, was it the same for you, that you were that heavily invested in your friends that I guess almost the sway of hormones, as the media suggests, that there was none of that there because you were more invested in your friends becoming parents than any kind of overbearing urge to keep the baby?
Yeah, 100%. The giving the baby back thing is the line that I use when people say to me, you're giving the baby away, and I'm like, no, I'm giving them the baby back. You know, we had IVF with their embryo. However, whatever route of surrogacy you choose, the child is always the baby. That is always in my mind. And my whole motivation, yeah, was my friends becoming parents. And actually, the baby that I have recently had for our friends is only 3 weeks old, so right now I am expressing milk for her. But yeah, all of the amazing things that I get to experience now, they're sending pictures of her being introduced to her grandparents, you know, the first time that they've bathed her, just the stories and how excited they are about this life that they now have because of us. It's just incredible.
It sounds like it's been a very, very rewarding experience for all of you.
Yeah.
Sarah, you mentioned that you're now, would there be a term for the children of a surrogate baby, or is this something that you might pioneer yet?
The thing is, surrogacy has been around for like 30, 40 years. So, you know, there will be some surrogate grandchildren somewhere along the lines. But I think sometimes people get really preoccupied with, it's, you know, you're having a baby, you know, and that's all that they think about. Well, you're giving a baby up. And then they actually don't think that baby's going to become a toddler and a 7-year-old and a teenager that, you know, has all the sort of teenage angst, and then, you know, is an adult going off to university and then like getting married and having children. So it's not actually just about having a baby for someone. It's sort of creating an individual that goes on to have this amazing life with parents that have so longed and waited and planned for that child, that actually you've got to start thinking about, you know, that you're creating an entire life, not just a baby, for those parents. And I don't think that's something I properly sort of thought about at the beginning. But now, like 21 years down the line, I sort of try and impart that onto surrogates that are joining and intended parents, that actually, you know, this just carries on. This good feeling just carries on for decades. It never goes away. And I don't think that people understand that, you know, after 20 years, you can still feel that swell of pride when you talk to, you know, an adult's mother who is talking about their child going off to university and starting jobs and getting boyfriends, and you still feel that pride that actually you've created that life. Like, there's no, it's indescribable, that sort of feeling, and that just continues and carries on. So yeah, so I don't know how I feel when those surrogate babies end up having children of their own. I just know that it's just more extended family to add to the mix.
And I know the surrogates we've got with us here today, they've all kind of spoken about how rewarding they've found the experience. And obviously you've just said that yourself as well, about how it then becomes even further rewarding to see your surrogate babies progress into childhood and then into teenage years and into adulthood. And then, as you say, them becoming parents themselves, all of which wouldn't have been possible without your part in the original journey. I mean, there's a lot on social media, a lot of comments about how surrogacy should be banned as it's harmful to the surrogates. But just listening to the stories today, it seems like nothing could be further from the truth. Hazel, you mentioned about having gay uncles, I believe you said, in your family.
Yes.
We haven't touched upon the surrogacy journeys that everyone here has embarked upon and whether they chose to help same-sex couples or heterosexual couples. Sarah, I'm not sure if we have the kind of ratios to hand or the data to hand about the percentages of couples that come into our organization that are same-sex couples, but I know there is a lot of there seems to be a lot of misconception on social media about how particularly gay men that are trying to force women track to surrogates so they can start a family. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's terrible, really, because a lot of the comments that gay men get when they talk about their surrogacy journeys is, oh, well, you're just trying to buy like a prop for your life, like just get a chihuahua or something like that. It's like, actually, fatherhood is just as valid as motherhood. You know, it's this horrible misconception that a father can't be a fantastic caregiver and parent and provide all the love and security that a child needs. We've had, you know, gay men have been able to adopt, and that's been really successful. And it's just crazy to me that gay men are sort of tarred with this sort of, you're buying a baby as an accessory, which couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, the same-sex couple that I helped in particular had all of the same, you know, drives as I did when I wanted to become a mother. You know, they wanted to become parents because they were in a loving, committed relationship and they wanted to share that love with their own genetic children. And that was exactly the same for me when I got married and had my children. And the fact that people think that same-sex men don't feel exactly the same as any other couple that want to start a family is absolutely crazy to me, and how we really devalue fathers in our society to the point that people don't believe that men could actually want children or have a biological clock that's ticking. You know, I love my dad. My dad is one of the most important people to me in my life, and I really value that relationship, and I feel sorry for people that don't value that relationship.
It's that that old phrase, isn't it, which we've heard several times as kind of testimony from the same-sex couples, is that they'll often get people say, oh, where's mum? You know, they'll be out with their sorrow baby and somebody will ask, oh, where's mum? Is mum at work today? And it's the old phrase, isn't it, that children need a mum, which surely the phrase should be children need a parent.
Yeah, every child deserves a parent that has planned for them, that desperately wants them, that can provide them with security and love. You know, nobody would question. I had my first daughter at 18. I was pregnant at 17. I had my daughter at 18. Nobody questioned whether my right to become a parent at 17, which is crazy to me. I was not prepared in any way, shape or form. And bless her, myself and my daughter, we muddled on through it. And she's, you know, like nearly, well, I'm not going to say nearly 30 in case she listens to it, but she's 27 and, you know, a wonderfully well-rounded, brilliant person. But actually it was a struggle for me as a teenager having a child, yet nobody questioned whether it was right for me to have a baby. But somebody will question two men who are in their 40s, who are financially stable, who can provide a loving home, that are emotionally giving and open. And everybody questions that. There was recently on social media, there was a lovely post by two men that were holding their newborn baby. And the comments were absolutely atrocious. Oh, I see that the mother's not in this picture. And I'm thinking, the last thing I would have wanted after just giving birth is for somebody to have taken a picture of me in my hospital bed to put all over social media. Because when I've had a baby, the only thing I'm concerned about is getting tea and toast. That is genuinely my priority. And a few years ago, both Tom Daly, and Lance's partner, and Robbie Williams and his partner had surrogate babies really close together, both born through surrogacy. Robbie Williams and his wife were absolutely praised and how wonderful, and congratulations in the social media. The press was so positive about them having a baby through surrogacy. Tom Daley and Lance Black got absolutely eviscerated in the press. How dare these men use this woman to have this baby, womb for rent, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just really bizarre to me that these babies were born like weeks apart and the media couldn't have been different. So it to me, it's homophobia. It isn't against surrogacy, because people are much more accepting of heterosexual couples that need surrogacy, of solo women that need surrogacy. People are a lot more accepting of that. And I say, can understand it more, that a woman would want a baby rather than a man wanting a baby.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like there's some very, very old fashioned thinking afoot still in the media to this day, doesn't it? Esme, you mentioned about being a daddy's girl. Is there any relevant comment we can make there about
thinking about it as
the father figure there, over the mother figure there?
And definitely we always said as children, I've got a sister, that if my parents ever split up, which they haven't, but we'd go one each and I'd always go with my dad. And I don't think it would have made me any worse off at all in life. So I think people that think that people require a mother is just so outdated. And to add, we have friends that sadly the mum actually died and the dad is now bringing up their daughter independently. And there has never been a comment or a question made about that. And how is that acceptable, that no one would question him bringing up a little girl as a solo dad, not out of choice, but people would when people want a choice. It's just a crazy world that we live in, I guess.
And I think in a modern society such as ours, where inequality with women is a thing of the past, isn't it? You know, it is. There's the inclusivity of that a woman can do any job that a man can do, and that this whole kind of gender stereotype around certain occupations is very much a thing of the past now. But it doesn't sound like we've caught up on the reverse of that role. And it's like, well, you know, if women can do any job that a man can do, surely two men or a single male parent can raise a child perfectly capably as well. It still sounds a bit one-sided in that sense. I mean, Hazel, going back to your family, and you mentioned you had uncles that were gay. Have they embarked upon parenthood, or is that something they would do? Or do you have any kind of case studies how you feel they would fare as parents?
Two of them would be of a different generation, really. And in Ireland, there is actually no legislation for surrogacy, so that's not an option. One of them moved to England when he was very young, and he's a step-parent. It was always in the back of my mind that it was very unfair, that it's just not an option for any of them. And when I embarked on surrogacy, it wasn't intentionally to help a same-sex couple, but that is just who I gelled with in the end. And that's, I have the same-sex IPs.
And you mentioned around the legalities in Ireland, and that obviously brings us very nicely to the fact that there is law reform afoot. How will the changes in the law, will they have a positive impact on surrogacy, or a negative, or an equal mix? How is that going to work moving forwards?
Certainly for surrogates, it will be very positive. I think lots of people have raised concerns about surrogacy in the past, and those concerns have been focused around the surrogate, and, you know, a surrogate perhaps being vulnerable or being coerced or not being well informed. And the legal reform addresses that. So, you know, by regulating surrogacy, it means that things can be put in place to make sure that everybody is informed, that everybody's had counselling, that everybody's had legal advice, that the surrogate is fit and well and able to sort of undertake a surrogacy journey, which isn't regulation at the minute. So actually, by putting those regulations in place, it actually ensures that safer surrogacy happens, which is the goal, which was always the goal for those campaigning for legal change, is that surrogates were protected and that surrogates should be able to undertake surrogacy if they chose to do it, not because they needed to do it. So the legal reform keeps altruistic surrogacy. There's no plan to move to commercial surrogacy at all. That was very definitely off the table. And in fact, the regulations around expenses has tightened up considerably. You know, at the moment, we have this phrase of reasonable expenses. So you can claim reasonable expenses for undertaking a surrogacy journey, which, you know, is quite difficult for people to understand what's a reasonable expense. Whereas now with the legal reform, expenses are put into different categories. So there are approved expenses that you can claim for. So actually, all these regulations are working hard to keep the things about surrogacy in the UK that we really value, which is keeping surrogates safe, making sure they're informed, making sure that it's always altruistic. So for me, especially from a surrogate point of view, the legal reforms offer more protection for surrogates. So I think that's a really positive move forward. And the other thing is that the Law Commission, who did the consultation about the legal reforms, really listened to what surrogates wanted, which, unfortunately, the surrogate's voice is the one that is the most unheard when people are having these debates and having these conversations. So the loudest voices in the room are very rarely surrogates. The Law Commission did its consultation and really listened to the surrogate's voice in the consultation. They listened to what we wanted. And there's this perception, this public perception, that a part of the law reform is around about legal parenthood. So at the moment, you have to apply for a parental order to become legal parents of any baby born through surrogacy. And because the surrogate and her husband are the legal parents of that baby until such time as the parental order goes through, which can be quite a while. And actually, surrogates weren't comfortable with that. We didn't want to be the legal parents of any baby born through surrogacy, and our partners very definitely didn't want to be the legal parents of any baby born through surrogacy. So they listened to our comments about that and have put in proposals for legal reform where the intended parents are the legal parents from birth. That doesn't mean that's taking choice away from the surrogate, because there are lots of different caveats in that legal reform that a surrogate can withdraw her consent at various times throughout the process, throughout the pregnancy, after baby's born, etc. And there are different pathways to follow if that happens. But for the overwhelmingly majority of cases, like 99.999% of cases, the surrogate wants the intended parents to be the legal parents at birth, to be able to do things like make medical decisions for their own children, to register the birth of their own children, to sort of be known as the legal parents of that child. And that was very much a proposal from the surrogates. They wanted that change to happen. And there is a perception in the public that actually that's intended parents and taking away the surrogate's right to choose, when actually it was the surrogates that pushed for that legal change, because we don't want to be financially, morally, legally responsible for a child that isn't ours. That's just crazy.
I was going to ask about the medical decisions specifically for you, Jen, because you and your husband must have had to go on the birth certificate from the moment your sorrow baby was born.
That's right.
And being only a matter of weeks old, surely like immunizations and all the important things that a baby has to have in the very early stages of its life. I mean, how has that impacted on you and your husband if you're classed as the legal parents at this point?
Yeah, like you said, we recently registered my surrogate baby, which was very strange, seeing our names on her birth certificate, even though neither of us or our parents are genetically related to her. The medical part of it, we actually did have a bit of an issue. The baby's parents took her home and she unfortunately got conjunctivitis, which they were mortified about as new parents, and they were on Google and they tried to register her at her doctor's, and the doctors actually refused to treat a 6-day-old baby for conjunctivitis because of surrogacy and just them being uninformed. So yeah, they've held their hands up since and said that they were wrong and it shouldn't have happened. But these things do happen, and it just really shouldn't. They shouldn't have had that stress as well as the new parent anxieties that they had.
So presumably to get that kind of, did you have to consent in any way for them to be able to take their own baby to the doctors to have that kind of thing treated?
We did offer to do that, and I said if they needed to speak to me, that would be fine. But in the end, they managed to get through it without me having to get involved. But it just shouldn't happen.
And I guess the same for you as well, Esme. You mentioned that you and your husband were very much done after two children. How does that feel to be, you know, in the eyes of the law, to have a third child in your sorrow baby, and have, you know, to be a part of medical decisions that you don't necessarily need to be a part of?
Yeah, so technically at the moment we do have three children. We had our second sorrow baby in February, and we were due to have the court hearing in August, and it's just been pushed back to November, which means it's going to be even longer that the parents don't get their names on the birth certificate. And it's even things like a passport. Obviously, when my sorrow baby was born in February, you're coming into the summer, and we knew that there was going to be no way that they were going to have had the PO done by summer. So therefore, they wanted a passport so that they could go on holiday like a normal family as such. So I did the passport application for them so that they were able to go on their holidays, because otherwise, technically, they wouldn't have been allowed a passport. They wouldn't have their names on the birth certificate. All of these things have knock-on effects, and which hopefully the law change will definitely help, as they'll be recognised from birth.
And then with you, Hazel, what was this made any easier? Because presumably one of your intended parents could actually go on the birth certificate.
Yeah, so because I'm not married, it was just my name and one of my IPs. But it was a very uncomfortable thing to do still, to register the birth. And there were some invasive questions about paternity and things like that. But it got done. But I did feel like signing my name felt really wrong. And we're really looking forward to parental order being done, but no sign of it yet. It seems a bit of a slow process. And also it's all to be done by post. So when we send one thing, they send it back because one of us missed a middle name on one page. It's just laborious. But
And how, I mean, we've mentioned these legal reforms, and you mentioned guidance, issuing guidance as well, Sarah. How has everybody found the process of registering the birth? Has there been a lot of, we covered old-fashioned thinking before, has there been a lot of that when registering the birth? You know, have people referred to you as mum or the mother and that kind of thing along the way?
I actually went on my own. My IPs were meant to come with me, but my first sorrow baby got a sickness bug and then gave it to the baby. Anyway, so they were unable to attend. So I actually went on my own. And when I walked in, the registrar said, "Oh, so you've managed to get some time off then?" Like, obviously thinking I'd just left my baby at home. Because when you book these appointments, it was literally like an online thing. There's no way to put surrogacy there. So the woman, when I explained, obviously was like, "Oh, I'm incredibly sorry." But her first presumption was that I'd just abandoned my brand new baby at home. And she was like, "Oh, nice bit of peace for you to come out." And I obviously then explained. But yeah, it was a unique experience.
Jen, how about for you?
I actually went with my IPs. We all went together, my husband as well. And they didn't really understand surrogacy, but the way that we got through the appointment really efficiently was that we did know. We knew that because my husband was my husband, we had to sign the paperwork. So we went well informed, and it actually was quite a positive experience. She did call me mum a couple of times, which I corrected. Yeah, I think it's just maybe people not being as knowledgeable about surrogacy, or being worried about saying the wrong thing and then saying it anyway.
And in terms of that kind of information and that guidance, Sarah, as an organization, I know we recently published a paper on, or co-published, should I say, a paper that was aimed at the medical community and midwives and that kind of thing. Just did that kind of go into more depth and explain the whole surrogacy process moving forward? Because I know that obviously we're now hopefully COVID times and lockdown times are very much a distant memory and very much in the rearview mirror. But I know that a lot of intended parents did have struggles in terms of being at present at the birth as well over COVID, just simply because of this mindset that they aren't, in the eyes of the law, they aren't actually the parents.
Definitely. And I think, luckily enough, the Department of Health did write some guidance for healthcare professionals, and that is very slowly trickling down to healthcare professionals. What I found is that actually the healthcare professionals, midwives, hospitals really want to do the right thing. They just don't know legally whether they can do the right thing. So I think when the legal reform goes through, that it will be so much better for the amazing midwives that take care of us to know confidently what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. So, for example, I've had four sets of intended parents. One set was a same-sex couple, and my hospital worked brilliantly to work out how to incorporate two men on a maternity ward, because obviously on a maternity ward is usually female, and it was about how to provide privacy to everybody within that ward, but also support the new parents with their baby. And luckily enough, my intended parents were allocated a private room on the basis that nobody else needed it. We would have had to have done something different if somebody else had needed a private room, but they were very lucky that there was a private room going free, and I was on the ward, and that worked really well. But that's because we included the medical professionals from very, very early on in our journey and gave them the confidence to be able to act confidently in supporting us all through the surrogacy journey. So when if the new laws are passed, then it will be so much easier for healthcare professionals to act for the benefit of everybody in a surrogacy team.
Sarah, like you say, with the making sure you speak to the healthcare professionals early enough, my waters went early at 32 weeks with my first surro baby, and we hadn't had our appointment yet to discuss with the hospital, and it was COVID times, and they told me that I was allowed one person in with me and that person couldn't swap, and I had to make a choice as to who it would be. Thankfully, I didn't actually go into labour because they basically said if I chose my husband to come in, I then wouldn't be allowed the intended parents in at all. They said that they would be allowed in as soon as the baby was born. And I said, so what's the difference within those 5 minutes of them coming in before the baby's born and after? And their argument was just they're the rules and that's COVID. So I definitely think that it will really help, and having those appointments early enough on to make sure everyone's on the right page.
Yeah, I obviously had baby Arthur during COVID, and it was a planned C-section. So we knew it was going to be a C-section, and the whole way along, the intended parents weren't allowed to be in the theatre with me, COVID, and they were to wait in an adjacent room, which I know hurt. They were really good and they were really understanding, and they didn't blame the medical staff at all, but I know that it hurt quite a lot. And then just at the very last minute, just as they were putting an epidural in for me, the theatre team obviously got together and spoke with each other, and the midwife said, do you want baby's mum in? And I just instantly started crying, because I knew that that would have such an impact for her to watch her child being born. And when she came in, we were both in floods of tears, and the theatre staff were in floods of tears, because it was just, it just added that human element. There was the team there just understood how important it was for a mother to see her baby being born, to be there in the room while her baby's being born. And so, that will forever go down as one of my favourite surrogacy experiences. And I was being cut open at the time, but it will still go down as one of my best life experiences ever, is watching my intended mum be handed her lovely son.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks for everybody for weighing in on the aspects we've covered. I'm just going to probably wrap up the podcast just by going through. I've got a list here of some of the golden favorites that we've had come off of Twitter in terms of people's misinformed opinions about surrogacy. And I think we've covered quite a few of them over the course of this podcast, but I am just going to rack out some of the ones that I don't think we shone enough of a spotlight on. And I'd invite the guests here today to just kind of weigh in and just give your viewpoint on some of these. So if you're happy to, then we'll kickstart with surrogates suffer trauma and regret after the baby is born and have no way to get the baby back because they have been paid.
What? Absolutely not. No one is paid. We don't want the baby back. And we are, like Sarah said, we're part of SUK and the Friendship First ethos, and we actually see the children being brought up by their parents in the majority of surrogacy.
And I think it's fair to say for the surrogates who you know, all the surrogates here completed their families first, as Esme rightly said, you know, if you wanted to have another child and add to your family, there are far easier ways to do it. I think Jen sort of intimated that they almost sound like there was a bit of sadistic joy in seeing the IPs take the baby and the struggles that come with it of early parenthood.
Yes, I don't think they realised how little sleep they would actually have. Yeah.
My two sent a video of her first poo. They were in a different room to me in the hospital after she'd been born, and I took great pleasure in seeing that, and I was sitting in a different room having my tea and toast. It was lovely.
Yeah, I think that's really an underrated benefit of surrogacy is the fact that you don't have to do anything after. Like, you can literally go home and sit on your sofa for 2 weeks before you go back to work and do nothing. It's lovely. And surrogates generally heal really well after surrogacy, after giving birth and stuff, because they're not actually taking care of a baby after. It's really nice. It's a really nice experience.
Well, I don't think Jen would mind us just clarifying. How old is your sorrow baby?
She would have been 3 weeks on Monday, just gone. So,
and when are you back to work?
I was back at work last Wednesday. I work for an architect's practice. I love my career. I love my job, and my work weren't pressuring me into being back early. I just chose to be back because, like Sarah said, I felt well recovered. I had a home birth that was incredible, just one of the best experiences of my life, choosing to be a surrogate. So yeah, back to work, feeling amazing, but not fully having a lot of sleep because I have chosen to express for the baby, so I'm up twice in the night doing that.
I think without getting too personal, it's safe to say that working for an architectural firm, I doubt you went into surrogacy for financial reasons in that case, Jen.
Yeah, exactly that. It definitely was not financial at all.
Moving on in the Twitter golden greats, we have surrogates don't get any choice about whether they give the baby to the parents or what they do with their body. The IPs have all the say in their medical decisions.
Yeah, that couldn't be further from the truth.
It's completely up to the surrogate for the medical appointments as to whether we attend them on our own or if we'd like the intended parents to attend as well. Obviously, they're our friends and we would love for them to be included. So most allow them to attend as well. But obviously, some appointments might be slightly more personal than others. And it's always the surrogate's choice as to if they want them to attend or not attend. And I think intended parents are always so respectful and put your wishes at the forefront. In my second surrogate journey, when I was going for the lovely internal scans at the clinic, my IP, the dad of the first baby, he was like, the woman was like, oh, do you want him to wait outside? I said, he saw me give birth 6 months ago. I think he can stay in the room with this curtain around me. He's not going to see anything he hasn't already seen. But yes, everyone's always so respectful and understanding of them being able to come to medical appointment, but at the surrogate's choice.
And I think we covered it already. The part about the intended parents having all the say in their medical decisions if there was a risk they weren't even allowed in the room for the birth of their own child, there's going to be no way that they get a say in medical decisions around what the surrogate does or doesn't do with her body.
I think it's really important to note that actually even in the new laws that are being proposed, that the surrogate retains all the body autonomy. She still gets to make all the choices about medical decisions through the pregnancy, how she gives birth, that they're all, you know, all the surrogate's choice. She still retains all of the choice with the new legal reforms as she does now.
And finally, surrogates want the option to keep the baby at the end, and the law changes don't respect that. There's a few faces. I'm privy to the faces that are being pulled. I know our listeners aren't, but there's a few faces being pulled at that one.
So for me, it's definitely really patronising. It's really patronising that somebody else thinks they know what I think and feel better than I know myself. I find that really patronising that I can't make an adult decision, an adult informed decision about what I would like to do with my own body, and that somebody else believes that they know better for me. So I can make a decision about that, and I don't need that sort of protection because I am an adult and I can make adult decisions.
Well, thank you to everyone. I think we'll wrap up by saying thanks to all of my guests today. So Sarah, Jen, Esme and Hazel. And thank you especially to all the kind comments that we've received on Twitter over the years. I think it's probably safe to say that we would encourage anybody wanting to find out and learn more about surrogacy, that all the help and guidance around both the legal reform and just how surrogacy works in the Surrogacy UK journeys is available via our website, surrogacyuk.org. And we will definitely touch upon some more of the legalities and misconceptions around surrogacy later on in this series of podcasts. And thank you for listening.